Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, got so. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
that was a big mistake. Yes, it was. That was a big mistake, giving nuclear power a try. Didn't work very well, as we know. That was David Burns singing with Dar Williams and Pete Seeger, the wonderful, fabulous Solartopia song. It appears on the Tomorrow's Children CD, a Grammy-winning CD from Appleseed Records. And we are back with another hour, fun-packed hour, sun-packed hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to be joined in a moment by Neville Williams, the author of a book called Sun Power. But first, I want to join the multitudes chiming in. I'm a sports fan, folks. I have to admit it. I did used to play ball. The older I get, the better I was. I was captain of the my high school tennis team, and I was actually the first sophomore to letter there in tennis, and the first to get three letters in tennis. But we wouldn't have much of a tennis team, but we were good enough, and I wound up with a letter jacket, prompting members of the football team who were at least twice as big as I was to take great exception to that. Nonetheless, this owner, this scumbag, Donald Sterling. I love how much media attention it's gotten. The owner of the Clippers, who's been making racist remarks, oh, for nigh on 30 years, and suddenly is discovered he's outed by his, well, if that's his girlfriend, I hate to see someone who's not. But the point is this. You know, all the greats, from Magic Johnson to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to whoever else, have weighed in on the fact that this team, the Clippers, who have a miserable record, by the way. I mean, you can see why Clippers have been so bad over the decades, and they're only as good as they are this year because they got help from David Stern, the chairman of the head of the NBA, who got them a trade to give him a great guard named Chris Paul. But nonetheless, he's caught making racist remarks finally, and what everybody knew all along has become public, and people are screaming and yelling he's got to sell the team. That is not the solution, folks. The solution is that the public should own all these teams. All these teams, all these football, baseball, basketball, tennis, soccer, lacrosse, you name it, teams, need to be owned by the public, need to be owned by the towns in which they reside, because we're the ones who get stiffed for all the stadium fees and tax breaks and the parking and the policing and all that other stuff. There is one in all of Major League Sports. There is one team that's owned by a community. That's the Green Bay Packers. And I happen to own two shares of the Green Bay Packers I sent in a long, long time ago. I have no voting rights. And they entitled me to absolutely nothing except a certificate that says I own a part of the Green Bay Packers. But nonetheless, the solution to scumbag owners like Donald Sterling and that jerk that owns the football team in Washington, D.C., whose name I will not repeat, his racist, anti-indigenous, epithetical name. Shame on us as a nation for tolerating a football team with that name in our nation's capital. Nonetheless, the problem is that these teams are owned by robber baron billionaires but nothing better to do than show up at courtside with their girlfriends. And some, actually, I don't think there are any female owners now. There was a female owner of the of a WNBA team, a women's basketball team. And so, but at any rate, these teams should be owned by the public. They are public property. They are. They should be condemned by eminent domain. The Fifth Amendment has a clause in it that says that we can take the public, the government can take property with just compensation. And every one of these teams should be owned by the people who support them, namely us. The Green Bay Packers have a great record as a municipal owned franchise of going to the Super Bowl. They've had fabulous teams on the field. They don't have racist, bigoted, robber baron owners, and it's time that we moved in that direction. So there you have it. And it's amazing to me also that hour after hour after hour, and I've watched a lot of it, we have these people ranting at racist Donald Sterling and yelling about the name of the team in Washington, but nobody talks about public ownership. And that's the only solution. These teams need to be publicly owned. We've given them billions and billions of dollars in handouts. You know, they're worth a fortune because of the public support of these teams, and it's time that this nonsense ended. So you heard it here first. I am genetically, I was born in Boston. I am a fan, a member of Red Sox Nation, of the Celtics Nation, but I also root for the Green Bay Packers because I own a part of them, and the Columbus Blue Jackets and the Columbus Crew because I live in Columbus, Ohio. But nonetheless, we need to own all these teams. Enough is enough. And you heard it here first. Unfortunately, I don't know why I'm the first one in the media that I've heard to bring this up. Maybe there's some other people talking about this, but all of these teams need to be public owned, and it's time we got away from these billionaire robber baron racist idiots. Okay? So thank you so much for listening into that. Now, Neville Williams, are you on the line?
Yes. Hi. Hi,
Harvey. I hear you great. The sound quality is fine.
Well, now I'm having trouble with you, but maybe one of my ears is bad, but I'll get by. I can hear you.
Well, use the other one.
Yeah, I'd have to, but that's I can't talk out of that ear.
Really? I can.
No, I'm just
all right, so
we're good.
Anyway, listen, Neville Williams, you are the author of a wonderful book, which you were kind enough to send me, and we're going to devote the full rest of the hour after my rant on sports ownership to talking about your book, SunPower. It's filled with a lot of stories, personal stories of your own about how you got into the solar business. You have a kudo here on the back from Arthur C. Clarke.
That was from my other book.
Did you actually meet Arthur C. Clarke?
Oh, yeah, very much. Every time I went to Sri Lanka, I'd check in with him. He lived there for 30 years, you know, and he had a little institute that studied photovoltaics, PV, solar technology. And, of course, he invented the geostationary satellite, believe it or
not.
Well,
tell us about that.
Well,
what kind of guy? I mean, did you sit around and smoke pot with him? What's the deal?
Yeah, well, hardly. He was an older man. Of course, he had polio, so he was in a wheelchair much of the time. He went to Sri Lanka when he was a young man to, well, not so young, but he was already a great science fiction writer. He was also a physicist. And then he went to Sri Lanka to do scuba diving. And he had a scuba diving organization there, and then he got polio somewhere along the line, and which he could still do, even he could swim if he couldn't walk. But he really believed in PV because he believed, and he inspired me because I was out there. I was the first country we worked in with solar to bring solar to rural people off the grid, have no power. And that wasn't, they weren't environmentalists. They weren't putting solar in their house to feel good. They were doing it because they could have an electric light. And we proved to the World Bank and many other people that, you know, hey, this is the cheapest way to get solar. More than that, I mean, electricity. More than that, it's the only way they're going to get electricity, or they're never going to get electricity. And so we broke through academia and all the experts and the people who said, well, is this the right technology for them? And I'd say, well, there is no other. You know, solar was new. It was expensive, but a small panel could light up their lives. Also provide them with radio and TV, and Arthur C. Clarke's vision back in the 70s was if you put these satellites up there, you know, you could bounce a television. Actually, his first vision was 1945. He wrote an article about in some major magazine about this idea that you could put a satellite up there that would stay put. It would stay in the same place. I don't know how he figured that out. And then he said, you know, what you could do with that is you could bounce television pictures up to it and back down. His little problem with his idea where there were no rockets to take satellites up, nobody had television. So this guy was an amazing visionary, even though he was really a science fiction writer. So
Arthur C. Clarke is really one of my great literary heroes.
Oh.
He wrote two of the most influential books on my pathetic little psyche that I ever read. The first was Childhood's End,
right,
which talked about, you know, the evolutionary leap of the nations of our human species.
Yeah.
An incredibly brilliant book. And then the other one was, of course, 2001 itself,
yep,
which became a hugely successful movie, an important movie, but also was a great allegory for a human leap of consciousness.
Well, I think so. Of course, the movie was. I never really got into the book at the time. And I'm not a science fiction reader myself, although I have friends who are. And I know some writers. But his vision for the developing world, which was our vision, was people could, you know, have electricity. People could leapfrog into the 21st century without wires, as we've done with solar cell phones around the world. And so he believed in that, and he supported us, and, you know, he always loved all of us, and we're working on this, and put his name on the stuff. And then he did like that book came out. That book was 10 years ago. Lots happened in solar since, which is why I wrote another one, which is why I wrote Sun Power.
Okay, so enough of a – well, again, to me, Arthur C. Clarke was beyond a celebrity. Yeah. He was an incredible visionary. And I was not a big science fiction reader either. But, you know, 2001 is only about 100 pages long. Yeah, you know, you can read it really quickly. And it's very clear in 2001 that he's talking about an evolutionary leap. And, of course, Childhood's End. I think Childhood's End – was made into a film also, but I don't think it got, of course, it got, 2001 is one of the most influential movies of all time. I don't think that Childhood's End had the impact as a movie anywhere near 2001.
Well, speaking of heroes, I think I heard Pete Seeger at the beginning of your show, right?
Yeah, Pete Seeger was a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah, I knew him, and I saw he was on the cover of Home Power magazine some years ago at age 90, putting solar panels on his own roof himself.
Yeah. Well, Pete also, you know, Pete had one of the world's first all-electric pickup trucks.
No kidding.
If not the first. I mean, he had this old beat-up pickup truck,
yeah,
and he just took the engine out and stuck in a whole boatload of batteries. And it was, you know, just car batteries.
Yeah.
There was nothing sophisticated about this thing.
Yeah.
And he would just hop in it and drive it down to the town a couple miles away and then drive it home, and that was it. But, you know, it was a totally electric vehicle.
Yeah, some people had the vision, but we've certainly come a long way from that, from the people who just were visionaries to actual practice today. That's what's so exciting about solar, and that's what I try to talk about in the book, you know, so that it's make a boring subject interesting, because everybody's interested in solar energy, but few people know much about it. And then, you know, it can be a boring subject, so.
It's boring, and it's kind of like safe sex.
Well,
you
made it interesting with your book, Solartopia. That inspired me, too, because you took a big leap.
You.
That's an important book. I've given away lots of copies and told a lot of people to read it, and, you know, it changes lives, you know, when you get people start thinking about things. But, you know, books are just a little drop in the bucket. There's got to be many other. I mean, a radio interview like this is good. I hope some people hear this and turn around and do something in this world with solar.
Well, listen, let's talk about what you've done. We're talking about Neville Williams. Are you in Naples, Florida? Is that
I am. I moved from Washington, D.C. about 3 or 4 years ago down here full-time. Yep, we love it. I got tired
of Washington. Well, that's a wise move. How far are you from the beach?
Not too far. It's lovely. Yeah, not too far. But, you know, Washington's a great place for about 27 years. You get a lot done there. But it was time to go.
Okay, so tell us your personal story, Neville Williams. The title of your book is Sun Power. Give us a URL or a website.
Yeah, www.sunpowerbook.com. And the subtitle is, let me reach for a copy here.
I don't see a subtitle. Oh, how energy from the sun is changing lives around the world, empowering America and saving the planet.
Yeah, well, so saving the planet might be a reach, but there's a piece of it. It's saving something.
Well, if you do a second edition, I think you should have how energy from the sun is changing the world, lives around the world, empowering America, saving the planet, and helping people have better sex.
Maybe that's missing in the book, so maybe another chapter. Yeah, it might. Well, anyway, I just know I was a journalist until I'm midlife, and kind of fell into this through the Carter administration when I came in to write speeches for the first Assistant Secretary for Solar Energy and Energy Conservation at the DOE.
And who is that?
Omi Walden was her name.
Okay, you were a speechwriter.
Yeah, and I mean, I learned about the stuff. I mean, I was a writer. I was a pretty widely published journalist, mostly magazine, and the fastest way to the poorhouse is to be a freelance journalist.
That's correct. Being freelance journalist is another word for being unemployed.
Well, kind of. So, enough of those years, and I did work here and work there and took the odd things. But solar came along, and I was looking for something interesting to do. I'd been very active in the anti-war movement, and that was kind of cause-related, which also required communications, and I was a correspondent in Vietnam, freelance, so on. And then the solar...
Wait a minute. You were a freelance correspondent in Vietnam?
Yeah, I'm old.
And who did you write for?
Rampart, the Denver Post, Boulder Daily Camera. Remember Ramparts?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. God knows everybody else. You know, all kinds of little magazines. And
how long were you actually in Vietnam?
Latter part of 68 and first part of 69. I got out in a hurry. I didn't want to make my career in that war. It was a pretty horrible thing. I wanted to see
it. You were there for the Tet Offensive?
Just after.
Uh-huh.
Just after. But anyway, that was enough of that. You know, and I didn't want to spend my life devoted to, rewriting and worrying about Vietnam and the aftermath. Now we're coming to more wars, or even dumber than that war. And that was a dumb war, but Iraq and Afghanistan are 1,000 times dumber, and we just never learn. But, you can't go through your life just being anti this and anti that. So the solar was something I liked, but it was pretty early on in the Carter days. He was big in solar, but a lot of solar hot water. Energy efficiency was the big success of him and his administration. But I got the idea of solar, and then of course Reagan came along and wiped it all out. And I went and did other things for 8 or 9 years, and then I got back into it when I moved to D.C. and ran into this company, SolarX, which later became BP Solar, and that has its own story. But did some consulting, and then I realized the price had come way down from 10 years earlier. And I started to think, I traveled a lot in the developing world and was still doing that. And I said, these people don't have any electricity in these countries. What if we set up an organization that could make it easy for them to buy it, not give it away, but actually put solar in their house, enough solar to run 3 or 4 compact fluorescent lights, and, you charge a battery as a charge controller, and they can run a black and white television. So we did that, set up an organization, and that things took off. We worked in 11 countries and raised many millions of dollars, and we did what I call pilot or seed projects, which led to government programs and World Bank financing and, setting up commercial entities that copied this, and it just was good. Now, I was one of the early ones to do it of a good scale, large scale, but many people doing that now, and it's become a big thing in the developing world. So that was the first stage, and one thing led to another, and then before I know it, I was in business, and that's, to go on and on about that was,
I want to hear about it, because, we're at the stage now with renewable energy. Where advocacy is fine.
Yeah.
But we're starting to get people advocate, who, when you hear advocacy coming from a certain group of people, you know you've won, right?
There you go.
You know you're over the top.
Right, right. We're way past that, which is fine.
Right.
I've seen the progression, and it's really exciting progression, because I didn't know where this was going, but I knew that his stuff worked in the third world. Well, after I came back, after 10, 12, 11, 12 years of that, and basically, we took a project in India and turned it into a company called Solar Electric Light Company, and we found European investors, and we were the first American-owned solar company in India. And now that company, many years later, that was 1995, 20 years later, it's having the 20th anniversary this year, it's electrified 150,000 families. And these aren't little solar lanterns. These are proper electrified houses with light switches on the wall, and it keeps growing. And it's not the only company doing this. There are dozens of companies doing this. So that was a success, I think. And I learned how to run a business.
Are they profitable?
What's that?
Are they profitable?
Yes, well, yeah, it makes a small profit, but they plow it all back into growth. They have patient investors who, and that's kind of the new kind of investing in some of this stuff we're seeing around the world. People who impact investing, they call it. They have the money. They don't want to return. They're already rich, but they don't want to piss their money away on in philanthropic ventures where the money just evaporates or studies or think tanks. And, you know, they actually want to do something. So with capital, you can do a lot. And so we went from...
Wait, before you... Let's yeah, sure. Nail this down for our listeners. What is the name and what is the URL of this company in India?
Selco India, Solar Electric Light Company, selco-india.com.
S as in Sam, E-L-C-O dot India.
No, hyphen India.
Hyphenindia.com. What you've done with this company is you have home-based PV and photovoltaics, and each installation powers an individual house.
Yeah. That's the concept. And now the company also does large-scale stuff when they're asked, institutional, universities, private businesses. But they're largely committed to the rural people and who are not necessarily poor. They just don't have any electricity, and the government's not going to bring it to them because the government is so, you know, let's face it, the governments in these countries can't do a lot for lots and lots of reasons. I won't go into that. But
in this case, though, we're actually glad for that. I mean, you know, we see people out there. And I'll go really, you know, policy here. People telling us that we have nuclear plants so that they can build a grid and power up the poor people of the world in places like India, Africa, and Latin America.
Total bullshit. But
it's insane.
It is.
You are, you know, because the only way to do this really is to have so-called distributed generation or home-based photovoltaics.
Exactly. And that proved to me this was fun. I mean, it made money. I mean, we raised money. The investors were happy. It's still going strong. I closed our office in Washington in, some years later, and then, moved our office to Bangalore and hired Indian guys who run it. It was all up to Indians. I didn't run it. I just started it and raised the money, and I was chairman of the board. Would fly over for board meetings and check on things. But I wasn't a technical guy or much of a businessman, really, except that I seemed to know how to raise money and talk rich people out of their money so they put it into something useful. And that's what's good. But then when pretty soon I'm running a corporation, came back to America and wrote a book, and the last chapter of the book of that book was called The Solar Age for You and Me. And I convinced myself to start a company in America. My wife said, well, you know, why don't you do this? I mean, she convinced me, but the book sort of indicated there's an opportunity here. Well, the question was, all the people I meet over 10 or 12 years would say, well, why aren't we doing it here? Where can I buy solar? That they didn't care about these people in the third world, you know.
really. Yeah, right. No. Well, now, one thing real quickly, a little detail. I assume that the task of electrifying individual homes in the third world, or as someone more recently called it, I think more accurately, the two-thirds of the world.
Yeah, that was Paul Hawkins' idea. Yeah, Paul
is has been made a lot easier with the advent of LED lighting.
Well, that really revolutionized it, and that's post my period, because we were struggling with compact fluorescents, which have to have they can only run an AC, and, you know, solar panels make DC, direct current power, and so there were a lot of technical issues with it. But, of course, compact fluorescents were much more efficient than you can use incandescents, will just use too much power. So, but the lighting revolution of LEDs is just unbelievable. We've converted everything in our house to LEDs. And of course, they're not hot. They last forever. Our community, I live in Florida, we put LEDs on all the coach lights in the whole house, like 500 lights, and then we took all our street lights and made them LEDs. And the boulevard out front of our house are all LEDs. So this is moving fast. But when it comes to using solar in these people's houses, yes, our company offers compact fluorescent lights for sort of room area lighting and then task lighting with LEDs. And yeah, you can make smaller panels, smaller batteries, cheaper. And so this stuff is very successful. But back in America, I said, well, gee, I was at the age I should have retired, but I didn't have any money to retire on. So I said, well, I guess I'll do this again. So I started a company called Standard Solar. You know, that's www.standardsolar.com.
Do you have a picture of John D. Rockefeller?
yeah.
He started. Are you the inheritor of Standard Oil? Here
exactly. I'm glad you made the connection. I figured, well, the name worked for him. I'll try that. Standard Solar, right. You know? What the hell? And I think it's a billion-dollar name. The company's worth, you know, company's doing about $45 million a year now. I retired from that some years ago, wrote this last book. But what happened with that company is I did raise enough money to hire the first 15, 20 people, and we basically figured out how we could sell solar in the Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia area, where there's a pretty high income, as you may know. These counties are wealthy, and these are pretty a lot of environmental consciousness. And this was 2004-5. Al Gore's book and his movie was coming out, and there was lots of concern about the environment. Big global warming was the first time. The cover of every magazine was about global warming, and people would say, "I want to put solar on my house, but I don't know who to call." Well, we solved that problem. We gave them someone to call, and the phone never stopped ringing off the hook. And that was solar was expensive then. It was $350 a watt. And people wanted to reduce their carbon emissions so much they came up with the money before there were incentives, before the federal tax credit. Well, now we have incentives, we have federal tax credit, we have, and what's happened since then is the price of solar, thanks to Chinese manufacturing, which is another whole story, has since 2008 dropped 75%. So now people are buying solar because it's the economic way to go, and many don't care about the environment so much as, hey, I'm going to get cheaper power here in the long run, and we can talk about that. But so I got into business in a big way, and then some private equity guys came and said, well, we're going to put more money in the company, and we're going to offer you a chance to go away with a little money in your pocket and keep some stock. I was ready, you know. Younger, smarter guys with more money came along, and they plowed a lot of capital into it. And it's grown, and it's got 90 employees. The company in India, by the way, I was going to mention, has about 300 employees, so they're doing well. And they pick their payroll every week. But Standard Solar is doing well, too. But there's a lot of competitors now. The biggest is Elon Musk's Solar City, if you've heard of that. Mm-hmm. They're doing really well. They're in many states now, giving us a hard time in Maryland. But I've seen this stuff go from, you know, a little panel that'll help a third world peasant have electricity to massive, massive solar uptake and, you know, installations now worldwide. And the book talks about that. I mean, I talk about the last 10 years and what's happening. It's pretty exciting.
Well, great. So that's a, you must have a touch for business.
Not really.
Let me know when you go into partnership here.
I wish I did.
I mean, I have no touch for business. That's why.
I think that's my message. I figured if I can do this, you know, with no business background, no technical background, no financial background, I'm just a journalist, I'm a writer, kind of like you. I said, if I can do it, anybody can do it. So I'm encouraging young people to become entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, to get into this business at any level. I mean, there's huge corporations that are in it. I can name them all. There's a huge commercial installation business like Standard Solar. Then there's a residential. Standard Solar is doing less residential, more commercial. Residential. Every town in America should have a residential installer, right? Like every town has a plumber, an electrician, right? Should have a solar installer. And many do, but not enough. Because there's still people saying, you know, I've heard about solar. I'd like to put it on my house, but I don't know who to call. So there's some tremendous opportunities for what's going to be a gigantic multi-trillion-dollar business in the future. It's already solar now is a $100 billion a year industry. Most people
know that. $100 million.
$100 billion.
$100 billion or million? B as in boy. $100 billion industry.
Yeah,
the solar industry.
Yeah, there's 130 gigawatts of solar around PV. I'm not talking any other technologies. Just solar photovoltaics. 130 gigawatts around the world. The leader is Germany, of course, where the sun never shines, but it doesn't seem to matter. And then in America, most people don't know this, there are 440,000 residential solar installations in the United States. And one installation is being made in America every 4 minutes. How about that?
So during the show, let's see, 4 into 60 goes, so 15 houses are going solar between the time
I got
you on and the time the show ends.
And more is
and,
law.
And how much do you make on each one?
I wish, yeah. Well, I wish our company was doing them all. But anyway, it's hard. Moore's Law is applying to solar now because it's doubling every 2 years. And the head of the,
Incapacity.
Yeah.
You know, let's drop it with Moore's Law for a minute. We're going to take a short break. Neville, so you can run and jump in the ocean. We'll be back in about 3 minutes to talk further with Neville Williams here, one of the great solar entrepreneurs, obviously. And Neville, we're going to listen to a little bit of the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song from my buddy Dana Lyons, and maybe you can incorporate that into your sales pitch for your new companies. And we'll talk more about solar energy and how it's spreading, and maybe even how you can make some money on it. We'll be back in 3 minutes or so. All right. Dana, my man Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns fame, 2 million hits on the internet. Go visit Cows with Guns, listen to Dana Lyons, and see why you should become a vegetarian. We are with Neville Williams, author of the book Sunpower and entrepreneur extraordinaire. I got to play a little solar geography for you, Neville. Do you know a guy named Amit Ronin?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, Amit was the main, he's married to my niece, he's my nephew, and more importantly, he's the father of my two beautiful grandnieces and my grandnephew. And he did a lot of the solar legislation for Senator Cantwell. He's now a professor in solar stuff. I guess that's the best way I can say it. Either George Washington or Georgetown, George Washington University.
Oh, okay.
But let's go here. You are a guy who has actually made money in solar, and. And, you know, the world is filled with people like me who've been out there advocating getting arrested.
Yeah.
This is my 41st year fighting nuclear power.
Exactly.
And
wow.
In 1975, we had a conference in Amherst, Massachusetts, which needs to be renamed already, called the Tour Tomorrow Fair. And had Amory Lovins there. I'm sure you know Amory Lovins.
Oh, yes, sir.
And a guy named William Hieronymus, who had this wacky idea of putting 5 megawatt windmills into the ocean, which is now happening.
Right. Exactly.
We had a vision of a green power Earth. That's really where Solartopia had its origin.
Right.
Tell our folks out there what is so attractive now about solar. Just before the break, you mentioned Moore's Law. Now, I don't think many of the people listening probably know about Moore's Law, but why don't you give us an explanation and how it applies to solar?
Well, that's, you know, computers, chips capacity was doubling every year, every 2 years, I don't remember, but for years and years and years, we know now that, you know, you can get so much information on a chip that you needed on a something 20 foot square to do 20 years ago, right? So that's same with solar now. Solar is the fastest growing business in the world. It's doubling every 2 years. And I don't know, there's the head of the power regulatory,
Regulatory Commission.
No, not nuclear.
Federal Energy.
FERC, yeah. He said, solar is going to, you know, this is going to take over. It's the future, and he was saying it's doubling every 2 years, and that's a big deal for this industry. But it means there's a way to make money at it. People are going to make money at it. My friend Jigar Shah, if you've heard of him, wrote a book called Climate Wealth. He's predicting a trillion-dollar economy as people make money saving the planet. You know, dealing with climate change is going to open huge opportunities. Humans have to do something. Solar's one of them, and, of course, your book had the vision to see if you put solar with wind and a few other technologies. In 30 years, I think, Harvey, you're right. It's whatever years you put on that in the future, it's going to be there because, well, we have no choice, but it will work. It's not so much pie in the sky. It's going to work. I mean, it works. This technology is just phenomenal. It's almost magical. And, you know, there's been a lot of different technologies that have come along, but straight old polycrystalline and PV, photovoltaics, is the leader. And there was a report from Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, last year. And some of they have analysts that look into the future, right? They looked a little further ahead than you did, maybe too far ahead, but they figured PV would be the leading energy source in the world by 2070. Well, none of us will live to see that, but your grandchildren will. It'll be the main source of power. There'll be no oil or coal, so it's inevitable. It's just a lot of pain to get there, but meanwhile, a lot of opportunities.
Yes, and so tell us about some of these opportunities.
Well, you can invest.
Let's do this. Let's pretend instead of I'm an over-the-hill geezer there's a bright young, and I do teach college, so a bright young college graduate coming out of school with a really useful degree like history or poetry.
Yeah,
and
wants
to get into the business of saving the world, but needs to pay off student loans.
Yeah.
So how do they get into the solar business or whatever business that will allow them to do that?
Well, do what I did. You set up a company, you know, Delaware
wait
Corporation.
A minute. That's a major leap.
Well, no, it costs $10 to set up a company.
Okay.
$10 to register a company with your state or Delaware, and, you know, you can get a little packet and issue stock certificates and do the whole thing legal. You know, I know it sounds strange. I did have some help on my Selco. I had some Wall Street guys sort of showed me how to. It's kind of secret. You can go for 4 years in business school and never learn how to set up a company because they don't tell you. It's like a secret.
Go 4 years in business school and never learn anything. But
I think that's
story.
Right. Exactly. Don't get me started on that. But I don't want to insult too many possible listeners. But it's not hard to set up a partnership or a company. At least, in other words, if somebody's going to give you money, they have to give something in return. They have to get stock or an agreement that gives them a piece of what they're about. You know, and you have to value that. It's all about valuation now, valuation in the future. So you raise multiple rounds of money. We raised a lot of our first money for Standard Solar. The first million was, you know, $250,000. 50,000 increments was the smallest. And that's the kind of person you're talking to that takes a chance with some money. They trust the guy or girl that's going to do this and realize they can be make money at it. And you don't need more than $1 million. You can do it on less. I have some friends in Maine. They put $60,000 each of their own personal money in a company and never had any more investment. They're now doing about, 15, 18 million a year. They have 20 employees. They've got 3 offices in Portland and one in northern Maine and one in New Hampshire. And they're the largest solar provider in northern New England. And they
what do they do exactly?
They just install solar on people's houses.
Let's get to the nitty-gritty. If you go in the solar business, what are you going
to
do?
Well, you're going to find a way to get panels, either through a distributor or you're going to go straight to factories. It's a lot easier to get them than it was, and it's so much cheaper. Then you're going to learn. First of all, you have to learn the business, but there's plenty of young people willing to learn. You can take courses. That's a whole story, but, I mean, go online. Look at SEI.org, SolarEnergyInternational.org. That's nothing but nationwide training programs. I took the course years ago. You know, I could learn the difference between, watts and volts and amps, you know, and I forgot it all because I don't need that to know that. But, right. You know, electricians
you,
know that.
You do know not to, even if it's solar powered, you know not to stick your finger in a socket.
And you can get hurt too, yeah. There's electricians. Tie up. I know some guys who are successful because they tied up with local electricians who were tired of just wiring houses for developers and said, well, I want to do something. They know, they can understand this stuff in a minute. And so you get some technical expertise, you get some financial expertise, you get a little legal. You got to put a team together. But any guy can start it, and there's people willing to put money in little companies like that and get a piece of the action and keep a piece for yourself. That's kind of how business is done. Or you can go to work for a big company, or you can invest. If you're an investor, there's a few public companies like First Solar. I don't know all of them now because some have been bought. The biggest American company, SunPower, not one word. My book is named two words, SunPower. But
uh-huh.
SunPower has been around a long time. Very good product, quality. And they were bought by Total Energy of France, the fourth or fifth biggest oil company in the world. They bought them out. So they're no longer a public company in America. But you can invest in Total and, you know, big invest in solar. What else? First Solar, I don't know. A lot of them are private companies. It's not a big place to make
well,
money.
Let me run by a conspiracy theory by you, and I think that we're through it, but there has long been believed, and a good buddy of mine, Dan Berman, wrote a book called Who Owns the Sun.
Yeah, it's out of date, but I know the book.
Yeah, so the question is, was there a period of time in our history when the corporations stepped in and bought up these renewable technologies to keep them off the market?
Nope, there never was. I know all about it, and I know the people who are involved in it from day one. As somebody told me, corporations don't put tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars into something they're going to kill. They just don't do that. People really believe Mobile, Shell, even Chevron, still in solar. Let's see some of the others. They all got into this. Siemens got in, got out, got in, got out. GE got in, got out. But no, they thought it would work. But because this is a technology this is a people's technology, ground up, small grows big. But it's not a good top-down technology. Plus, these companies weren't geared to handle this technology, and they also expected miracles. Well, miracles take a while, and the solar miracle has occurred, but it's been a 30-year miracle, right? And so a lot of them just got in, and BP Solar was the big one. They were really terrific, you know, all over the world. We bought all our panels in India from BP Solar India, and then we had BP Solar in Maryland. We bought all our stuff. They were only 20 minutes up the road from our company, and they sold us to direct. They made great stuff. And the guy, Sir John Brown, he got thrown out of his company. It was a bit of a scandal. He was the chairman and in England, and they brought in a number two guy, was the bean counter, of course. And the first thing he did was get rid of the solar company.
And then they polluted the Gulf.
Oh, of course. I wouldn't want them to be in the solar industry. They don't deserve it. But their logo was Beyond Petroleum, BP. Remember all that?
Yeah.
And, you know, Greenpeace. I didn't mention, I worked for Greenpeace. Part of my transition from doing weird things and traveling the world and being a poor freelance writer, one of the transitional things is I took a job in Washington, which is how I got to Washington from other far-flung places, to work for Greenpeace as the national media director for a couple of years. Now, I knew nothing about...
Huh? Were you before or after Peter Dykstra?
I followed Peter. Peter hired me.
Oh, okay, cool.
And then
he was a great guy. A lot of fun, Peter Dykstra.
Well, he's amazing. He's doing good stuff. Still going. Yeah, he was kind of... I could never replace him. He was unique. But I had a little more maturity and experience in the media and was able to say, hey, Greenpeace has a hell of a story to tell, what it does, and then its issues deserve to be told. And they were busy jumping off smokestacks and, you know, going after whales and things like that, right? You know, the whalers. And they couldn't get their story out in a national way, and I sort of achieved some of that for them. But mainly I learned more than I gained or that I was able to contribute to Greenpeace. I learned about global warming. And I said, gee, you know, what happened to solar? Let's look at that. And that's kind of what drove me. Doesn't drive me anymore because I don't think the environment's driving solar anymore. But at the same time, governments should just by policy should say, hey, we're putting 38 billion tons of carbon into the air every year, and we don't have to do that. We're not going to stop that right away, and we can't undo 200 years of environmental damage from the Industrial Revolution. But as they say, if you find yourself in a hole, and you're digging a hole, stop digging, right? Well, we don't have to put any more in to live like we do. And frankly, the power of solar is such, as we're seeing now, with the vast solar farms. I should talk about the technology, if you'd like, in a minute. But
yeah,
the,
please.
Well,
and you know, we're actually down our last 14 minutes here.
Yeah.
Well, and I do need you to talk about the pushback that's coming from the industry.
That's exactly interesting.
Let's hear about that.
Well, the technology first is you hear about solar. Okay, there's concentrated solar power, which are these big things you see in California with the power towers, the mirrors focused on a boiler that makes steam that runs turbines like a conventional generating plant. And then there's two kinds of those, some that heat troughs of oil and the oil circulates, and others focus on a mirror. That's great, but they're finding these are such huge infrastructure projects that they're now too expensive, and some of the companies doing these billion-dollar projects are converting to PV because PV is... photovoltaics is cheaper. So that is one of the central, again, big companies like Wall Street loves these great big things. But you're seeing solar farms now up to 100 and 200 megawatts. The latest is a 200 megawatt plant being built outside of Austin, Texas, for Austin Energy, that's going to provide power to them for 5 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yikes,
now,
that's
now,
cheap.
That they can resell it for seven, which is, you know, that's less than gas, less than coal, and less than wind.
Well, but let me grab you here. You're talking about now, and this is a huge issue, as I'm sure you're well aware. Talk about the environmental and financial differences between photovoltaic cells on houses and photovoltaic cells in large central generating stations.
Well, the central generating stations have their place. The one thing about, I'm agnostic about all of it. I mean, I'm happy to see a 30-watt panel on a peasant's house in western China or Nepal, which we did. And I'm happy to see a 30-megawatt plant in New Mexico, you know, that Ted Turner built on his ranch for Georgia Power, if you can imagine, for, you know, provide power to the grid. So depending on where it is, you know, and if you have the land, I don't think it does environmental damage because critters can run around underneath it and get shade. You know, I've never seen that problem. But land's expensive. It's cheap in the West. I'm actually working on a couple large projects out there with a partner just for fun in New Mexico. So there's that, and then the houses, but we have a lot of rooftops in this country, and I just met this afternoon with Carl Bohr, who lives here, if you ever heard of him. He's America's leading semiconductor physicist, and he's the America's leading solar pioneer. He's retired.
How do you spell his last name?
B-O-E-R.
Yeah. Carl Bohr.
Yeah, he was the head of the Solar Energy Institute at the University of Delaware for like 40 years.
Okay.
Amazing guy. So he was telling me, you know, 65% of the rooftop coverage in America would provide all the power we ever need. He's a math physicist type guy who can figure out these numbers and come up with credible arguments, right? So he's amazing.
And he found if we didn't do every rooftop, if we only did 65% of the rooftops in the United States with solar photovoltaic cells, we would get all the energy we need?
Yes.
Oh, is that all the electricity or all the energy?
All the electricity.
It's not going to fly airplanes. There's a difference.
It's not going to drive cars unless you want to charge. You can charge electric cars, but you're not going to run airplanes. But
care of our automobiles once we convert to electric cars.
Well, exactly. Huh? So people with solar on their house can charge their cars in the daytime. Of course, if you drive to work, then you hope that your company where you work has a solar covered parking lot, which many do. That's a huge business. Charge your car. So we're seeing this revolution happen. I mean, when Cadillac is making an electric car, you know something's happened. But what's happening is you've just alerted to the pushback. This is pretty new. I touch on it in the book, but it's happened so fast. What's happened? Solar is now really threatening the business model, the fossil fuel industry, and in the centralized fossil fuel generating business model. It is. And these utilities don't want to change. And, of course, the Koch brothers come up with this legislation that they send to 50 states, and you probably heard. And here's some interesting news. The first one to pass a bill to say, if you put solar on your roof, we're going to tax you. The New York Times had an editorial 3 days ago in which it said Republicans finally found a tax they like. Let's tax solar.
Right. It's really sick. And
it means that solar is the cheapest, and I'm going to make a categorical statement here, and I couldn't have made it a year ago.
But it really does. You know, the Koch brothers make their money. I like to call them the Koch barons. Make their money in fossil fuels.
In King Kong.
So they are definitely threatened by renewable.
They really are. They have no. You know, it's really quite astonishing. But you know, it's not going over well. Arizona pushed back. Kansas, of course, was a typical state that might buy this. But most places, the pushback is so huge against this idiocy. And what they're saying is this. They say, well, people are using the grid and they're not paying for it. Wait a minute. Yes. It's like saying to bicycles and the bicycles, well, we're going to charge you $300 a year to ride on the road because you're riding on the road, but you don't buy gasoline, so you're not paying gas tax to pay for the roads. That's, you know, that could imagine how that would fly. There's no difference. Fact is, the actual grid is improved because you're making peak power in the daytime when the grid is threatened. You have blackouts, you know. Our grid is feeble in this country. It hasn't been updated in 50 to 100 years in many places. So solar going into it is good. There's really no technical issues. And the technical issues that do exist with putting solar through distributed or decentralized generation into the grid are easily solvable. It's just the utilities are too lazy. You know, they have monopolies. They have publicly regulated monopolies. They call them the public service commissions. I call them the private service commissions because they basically serve these companies. So we're seeing some... The dying gasp of an ancient way to do things. We've been doing it for 125 years, and it's going to change. And here's the good news: Oklahoma legislation passed something to say they allow the utilities to tax people who dared put solar on their house and use their precious grid, put power into their grid. Right? They passed this law last week. The governor yesterday signed an executive order, which said basically killed it.
Really?
This is a woman, Republican governor, says the intent of this bill is to constrain the Corporation Commission's consideration and approval of tariff applications with respect to distributed generation customers. And it goes on.
What state was this?
Oklahoma.
So
the first state to pass one of these Koch brothers laws about taxing solar, the governor undid it with an executive order.
Well, good for him.
Yeah, her.
I think they have a female governor there.
Yes, they do. I think she's Democrat, Republican, of course. I mean, a Democrat could ever be elected in Oklahoma. But, you know, even Arizona has had this. This started in Arizona. It's happening in Hawaii, where 10% of the homes in Hawaii are covered in solar because they're paying 25, 30 cents a kilowatt hour. Where
well,
you can get
ironically,
solar for
this
$5.
Is, I have to jump in here. This is one, I've lived in Hawaii, thankfully, and Hawaii, of all the states in the union, Hawaii is the only one that generates a significant amount of their electricity with oil.
Well,
because obviously they use oil. There's no gas and there's no coal there.
And they have to import it.
Yeah, it's insane.
Absurd. Well, Hawaiian Electric, which I thought was quite progressive, is pushing back themselves, saying, oh, they're going to overload the grid. We're going to put a moratorium on hookups. Well, that'll stop because the industry won't stand for it. The solar industry is pretty powerful these days. Got Solar Energy Industries Association in Washington, SEIA.org, if people want to look at that. By the way, you can find so much out on the web, as you probably know, Google anything.
Yes,
but so much is happening.
So, you know, we only got 4 minutes left here, Neville. You've been talking up a storm and doing great.
Well, appreciate the opportunity.
Is there a clearinghouse for people? People ask me all the time now, A, how do they get solar, and B, how do they get jobs in solar? Is there a clearinghouse for employment?
Yes, there is,
but
I don't have all those names. There is a 2 pages of appendix in my book that covers just about every website you'd ever need, and that includes one of those, but I'm not prepared to inform and answer the question intelligently. But you just, you know, Google solar jobs. You can go to the SEIA.org, Solar Energy Industries Association, and they have links to job websites. 143,000 people now work in solar PV.
Well, that's way more than works in coal.
Well, more exactly.
At this point.
And the biggest users, I mean, we're seeing Warren Buffett investing $1.5 billion. Bill Gates just put $1 billion. The next big thing is storage, by the way. That's going to be where to get the jobs.
Batteries.
Storage.
Now, somebody told me.
Not just batteries, but there's many other storage technologies, they've been around a long time. Nobody paid any attention to them because they didn't need them.
Capacitors, is that right? One of them capacitors?
Well, no, not that. But there's, it's complicated stuff. You pump, pump water in the ground, you pump air in the ground, and then there's the new battery stuff, and there's this, that, and the other. But it's people are throwing a lot of money at it, like people like Gates and Google and so. And also, these guys are throwing literally billions into residential finance. Google and SunPower just combined put a $250 million fund together for solar finance. So you can get in the financial end of the business and learn that. You can get in the technical end. You can get the business end, become an installer. I mean, there's so many opportunities. It's just crazy not to really take this seriously because, you know, the biggest users of solar in America, believe it or not, is Walmart.
Walmart, yeah, Walmart's probably going great guns on this.
And Walgreens, Costco, Kohl's, department stores, huge list.
Do you think if Walmart saves a bunch of money in solar that they'll pay their employees a decent wage?
I'm no fan of Walmart, no question. But who knows? they're not doing this for greenwashing.
Yeah,
because you can't see on these companies that put this up there. You can't see them, so the public doesn't know they're there. They don't put up a big sign and say our store is solar powered. La di da. They don't bother to promote it. They just put it because it's going to save them money in the long run. And
Neville, you have been a great guest. I cannot believe this hour has flown by. So I'm just going to have you back.
Well, I'd love to.
We'll talk some more. We'll talk about this being the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Okay.
And we'll see if we can't get some more great business advice in the amazing world of solar energy. Give us the website for people to go to again, please.
Well, for the book?
For the book and everything else.
Well, www.sunpowerbook.com and my own website. Well, it doesn't matter, but you can get to that from that book, from sunpowerbook.com.
What's the number one business you would recommend people looking up on the website?
Boy, there's so many I really can't say off the top. But if you went to SEIA.org, they can lead you all over the place. It is the industry's association, nonprofit, of course, and they put on the huge big solar show trade shows every year. Last one was in Orlando. It was in McCormick Place. Next year's Javits Center in New York. And these 20, 30,000 people looking at photovoltaics, you know, we're talking the big companies there.
Okay,
we'll
pick up on that. If it's in New York, I'll do a show from there with our great crew in New York. Thank you so much, Neville Williams, the author of Sun Power. Thank you, crew in New York. We will solarize our show as we go along. This has been another hour in the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness World. We'll be back next week with another great conversation. Thanks again, Neville Williams.
Thank you, Herbert.
We'll see you in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.